copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
My name's Delta David Geyer. I'm a conductor. That's what I do. I'm not a minister. I've been a professional artist all my life. I also happen to be a Christian. I'm sort of on a different kind of journey at the moment. I've never been to a conference like this before. I've spoken at many conferences, but everything having to do with music and professional life, that sort of thing. So I'm not going to spend really any time on the professional side of my career. You have a bio there if you know, because I'm not here to really talk about orchestras I've conducted and projects in the secular world that I have done. So why are we here? Why am I here talking to you about art? So alongside my professional career, which takes up most of my time, there are three ministries that I've worked with over the last 20 years. The first of them is the Masterworks Festival in the United States, and this was founded by Patrick Cavanaugh, who was the creator of the Christian Performing Artists Fellowship outside of Washington, D.C., and that's been going for 40 years or so. And out of that, and people that's in the D.C. area, National Symphony players, and people from the Kennedy Center, they created a summer festival. And the vision behind the Masterworks Festival was to train up the next generation of artists to be salt and light in what can be a very dark world, the professional arts world. And for now, 20 years of Masterworks has produced an incredible amount of fruit. It's quite an amazing thing. It's the most uneven orchestra I ever conduct, because my principal cellist sits in the Cleveland Orchestra and the last chair violinist is 14 years old and can hardly wipe his nose. So it's kind of like this, conducting wise. But you can imagine what it is for not just that 14-year-old, but the students range all the way up through their late 20s, postgraduates, some of them from the best conservatories, and it's international as well. So you sit side by side with the professionals, and they mentor you musically, but then in the evening, the entire festival breaks up into small group Bible study. And the curriculum is designed towards what is it to be, have a life as a Christian artist in the professional arts world. And it's not just music. There's dance, drama. It's a community of 200 to 250 people. It's a month long. And it's borne such incredible fruit over the last 20 years. So that's the first one. And I've been involved with it ever since the second year, like 1998. Was the first time I went. The second one is an organization called Soli Deo Gloria, which is Latin for "To God Alone Be the Glory." Its purpose is to commission new works of sacred music in the tradition of Bach and Mendelssohn and so on. We have a catalog now of about 30 contemporary compositions that are sacred, wide range, different composers, that sort of thing. It was founded by a mentor of mine named John Nelson. John had a big international career as a conductor, but his passion, his focus is sacred music. And so I've gladly opened a couple of veins for that organization over the last 15 or so years. More recently, I've become involved with a European ministry called Crescendo. And I conduct at the Crescendo Summer Institute in Tokaj, Hungary every year. I've been doing this for 5 or 6 years. The founder of Crescendo is maybe not the founder, but for decades now, the head of Crescendo is Beat Rink. He lives in Basel, Switzerland. And Beat's vision is nothing less than the re-evangelization of Europe through the arts. It's a grand vision. And if you know anything, I encourage you to check out Crescendo to see what they do across the continent and beyond. Actually, if you're anywhere near Basel, Switzerland, a week from Friday, June 2nd, is the second Night of Faith, Nacht des Glaubens. And it's about 50 different arts events happening simultaneously through all with the Christian message, all with the gospel. Throughout the city of Basel. So I'm going to be there. But so that's one thing that they do. Another thing they do is during the year is called Creative Churches. And a creative church service can last 3 hours or so. And basically it's bringing people back into the church through art. Not subversively. People know that they're coming to a Christian event. But there's music, there's dance, there's drama, there's visual art, very powerful events. So a few years ago, I had a conversation with Beat about expanding my role with Crescendo. And this has led to, it's actually led me here. Without going into too much detail, there was a project that we talked about creating. And it's with a sculptor who's here, who most of you know by now, Liviu Mocan. He's the five solas that you see upstairs by the plenary hall, right? Liviu and I have known each other for a long time. We had a vision for singing a new song unto the Lord. And it was a interdisciplinary work with Liviu as a sculptor, with András Viski, a Hungarian playwright, and a composer, most likely Peter Bannister, who lives in Paris. And then I was sort of the catalyst for bringing this together, and the idea was to create a work that was interdisciplinary with all of these elements and create it on a campus of a divinity school or some Christian college that in conjunction with the faculty, you know, with theologians. And we came up with several different possibilities of subject material for this. It was a fascinating thing, still is a fascinating thing. But the pursuant to my purpose in talking to you here, it's led me in a very unexpected direction. So one of Liviu Mocan's supporters is Philip Yancey. That name may be familiar to you, a Christian author. I'd never met Philip before, but Liviu put me in touch with him as a potential funder or catalyst for other funders for this project. So along with that, his wife, Rodica Mocan, put me in touch with Greg Pritchard, which led me to come here. And the trajectory was that we met in Cluj last summer in July, Crescendo Festival in August, went to Wheaton, Illinois, met with Greg Pritchard and others in September, and then at the end of November, my wife and I drove to Colorado to spend a whole day with Philip Yancey and his wife. And I was going there to talk about this project and how to get this going. And Philip basically said, "Your idea is half-baked." He said, "It's very interesting. Keep in touch. When it's ready, I'll help you." But he said, "I have another task for you. I think that I think at this time in our culture, there's a larger role for artists to play. And I want you to think about this." Now keep in mind, this is the end of November. The American elections were just about 3 weeks before, right? So big tumultuous thing, whatever your political proclivities are, it's an upset. And we're divided. The Americans are divided as a nation, as is Britain. very much. So how do we heal this divide? Obviously, it's not the politicians, because in America, for instance, there was a total failure of any politician to articulate a vision that would bring people together behind them. Absolute failure. There was no JFK, there was no Roosevelt, there was nobody that's able to have some sort of vision. So the question then is, who's going to do this? How do we bridge this divide? And my question in answer to that is, why not the church? And if so, how? So, with that in mind, I'm going to very quickly go through the outline that I supplied several months ago that I had to ask Natalie to remind me what it was today. And just quickly go through the three items with the idea of getting to a fourth item, which has to do with who we are as Christians in our culture right now, and what role do the arts have to play. And I'm not here to convince you of anything. I'm here simply to be obedient to what I think God may be saying to me, maybe through Yancey, I don't know. But maybe this is the beginnings of something else. So first of all, let's just go back to the first chapter of Genesis, when God, the ultimate artist, created, right? And gave his gifts then to mankind. We call this, or you theologians call this, common grace, right? God causes his sun to shine on the righteous and the unrighteous, and his rain to fall on the just and the unjust. He gives his gifts liberally to all men. I experience this as a professional musician, because it's very easy for me to resonate with Johann Sebastian Bach. He is a consummate artist, maybe the greatest composer that ever lived, also a very strong believing Christian. But I also conduct Richard Wagner. And this is amazing music, incredible music. Richard Wagner was a despicable human being, anti-Semitic, Hitler's favorite composer. You know, it was not a good thing, but the music is unbelievable. He's then the gift that didn't come out of nowhere. As a Christian, I recognize this. So, with the foundation of common grace, I'm free as a Christian to identify God's gifts wherever they fall. The biblical view of the artist is an interesting one. In the Old Testament, it's full of poetry. We have Psalms of David and others. We have other poetic writings. If you're a student of Francis Schaeffer at all, he probably the best delineation of God's gift to artists is written out in his writings. Bezalel is the prime example in Exodus of someone who was commissioned and given gifts. Somebody yesterday, Charles, actually suggested that this was the first example in the scriptures of a gift of the Holy Spirit was to Bezalel, and he was the one that was gifted to the artist that was gifted in designing the tabernacle. And Schaeffer waxes philosophical about this and goes into great deal about pomegranates that are of a different color than any pomegranate you would ever find in nature. Like, these are just amazing details that God seems to be interested in. All right. Art is very much present in the Old Testament. What's interesting, of course, is that it's not so present in the New Testament. Now, while Jesus obviously taught in the Solomon's Temple and there was beauty all around and artistic expression, we have very little. And what we have, I think, would argue that's perhaps been used to negative effect. The fact that it's not much mentioned, particularly since the Reformation, we've not given much attention to art and its impact. We have psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs mentioned in the is it Ephesians, I think, right? by Paul, and some denominations have actually taken that so far as to say, well, it doesn't mention any instruments, so that means we shouldn't have any instruments in church. We should only sing. So that's obviously way against the Old Testament, right, where we have clanging cymbals, and I think at one point there were 120 trumpets that were preceding the procession of the, was it the when the ark came to the temple, right? So we have this maybe a mixed message, maybe an incomplete message in the Bible about what art is. But then if you fast forward to the church historically, we see obviously great artistic expression in the Eastern and Western branches of the church. Incredible ones in Orthodox and Catholic expression. So which I call the church enriched. Now, a lot of these pieces of artwork were given because the majority of the populace was illiterate, right? So these were expressions that enabled people to come in contact with the truth of the gospel, with God's presence among them, you know, and vivid expressions. At that time, I would argue that the church actually led the world in all things intellectual and artistic, including the beginnings of the Reformation. If you look at, you know, again, going back to Schaeffer, the beginnings of science with Roger Bacon and so on, this was a period of discovery, uncovering the creation of God, understanding from a Christian perspective what God had created. And the church led this, right? So what happened now? Because we now as the church are not leading the world in these things, artistic and intellectual. So where is the disconnect? We began to think of art in particular as merely something that's in service of a message, that it's not a valid expression in and of itself. But, and to this day, I would argue not just in the evangelical church, but in the church universal, that art is an ancillary activity that's used in a utilitarian way for the message of the gospel. This is not a bad thing in and of itself, to think of art to be used in this way, but it's a facet. It's only part of the story. The way that it's now worked itself out over, particularly through the 20th century, and particularly during the last few decades, is that we have a marriage between art and popular culture and commercialism, which is problematic. And now we have the church as a follower of the culture. Now I would say, I would hope, just personally, that we are at a cultural low point now, because even in our, not just the church, but as a Western culture, we're not producing great works of art. Most people recognize this, but the church is following suit with this. So there was an important cultural study that came out in the mid-1980s by a New York University professor named Neil Postman, Amusing Ourselves to Death. And it was, I thought, a brilliant cultural study. He began actually with the very beginnings of how humans communicate information, and went through, you know, the beginnings of the printing press and so on. And then his argument back in the mid-80s was that television had totally changed the game. He never lived to see the internet. So obviously that's a big game changer. But this idea of amusing ourselves to death, the idea that news, and he did not live to see the 24-hour news cycle, cable news and all of that either. And now, but he did argue that the way we consume news is actually in an entertainment format and not actually having discourse. First of all, you can't have discourse with the television set to begin with. The ideas are given to you, and there's no, you don't give anything back, right? So it's unlike reading a newspaper. It's a very different medium. So, and obviously the internet changes that too. So we're entertaining ourselves, we're distracting ourselves, and now we have these phones and things that we can't even go to the bathroom without, you know, that we're like constantly, you know, looking at these screens and distracted. I often think about this, like when I talk to my sister-in-law who's not a believer, and she says, well, God is not speaking to me. And I say, Helene, how would you know? How would you ever know whether God is speaking to you? We're perpetually distracted by something else. When do you ever give yourself space to hear what God might be saying to you? Right? So at this point, I'd like to talk about a little bit of a controversial topic, which I have to talk about all the time, and that is the difference between entertainment and art. And I don't mean to address this as an elitist. Now, I am a classical musician, so obviously I'm engaged with art. My trajectory is not to get to the point where I say that popular music or popular culture has no place in the church. That's not my prerogative here today. But I do want to make this delineation, because if you look at the functions of entertainment and art, they're very different. Entertainment, by its nature, is designed to take your mind off of things, to divert your attention. And there's nothing really wrong with that. I mean, Blaise Pascal talked about this in his Pensée, right? He basically said, diversion's okay as long as you recognize that it's a diversion and you get back to thinking. But perpetually diverting yourself is not a good idea, right? So it obviously still has application today. But whatever it is, whether it's your phone or a movie or a television program, we're diverted by these things. Art, on the other hand, is created ideally to set your mind on something, to give you room for contemplation, to have you think about what the artist is saying. So this is, that's not to say that there's not entertainment that's artistically done or that there's no art that's entertaining. I mean, that's not a hard and fast line, but the functions are very different. I would argue that the majority, if not almost all, of what we do as a church falls into the entertainment category. How did we get here? So here's, I think this is a 20th century phenomenon. Well, first of all, popular culture is pretty much a 20th century phenomenon, particularly a second half of the 20th century phenomenon. And it's very tied up with entertainment and commercialism. But it's popular and high culture is different from folk music of past centuries and artistic expression. These are different phenomena. Entertainment it is what it is. It's something to divert our attention. But now we find ourselves in a place where we have a divide. And particularly within the church. But I would argue it's much larger than that. It's cultural. Between the artist and society, the artist and the church. So how did we get here? I don't want to get too heady about this, but I do a lot of contemporary music. I'm very involved in the contemporary music world. Why? Because I love it? No, I actually don't love contemporary music. I do it because I'm a believer. I believe in the process. I believe that one of my favorite sayings is, if you want to be a game changer, you have to stay in the game. In other words, you don't just get to sit on the sidelines and cast stones. Like, get in there and do the good that you can. So that's what I'm trying to do. I've served on the Pulitzer Prize Committee. I've just really thrown myself into this whole thing of contemporary music. But what I've noticed, and it goes back historically to the beginnings of the 20th century, the collapse of tonality in music, the collapse of so many things. I would say at the First World War, really. I think it's very hard for us to look back and assess the cataclysm that was the First World War. But culturally and artistically, it gives us a window. And one of my favorite composers is Gustav Mahler. I do a lot of Mahler's music. Mahler died in 1911. Mahler was a prophet, along with the other artists that he was living with, Gustav Klimt and Sigmund Freud and these people that were in Vienna at the time. They saw what was coming. There was an electricity throughout the continent, particularly the middle of Europe, that foresaw what was about to happen. Think of Edvard Munch's The Scream. This was pre-First World War. Right? This is existentialism. This is expressionism. Right? It's ugly. People, there was electricity going throughout. What happened, I could speak mostly to music, but there are parallels in visual art and poetry and everything else, is with the collapse of tonality, the major minor tonal system, the things that we resonate with, literally resonate in our bodies, that we became unable to relate to what composers were saying. What I see still in composers composing today is what I would say is navel gazing. It's a lot about self-expression. This is what people are taught. And, you know, we talked about this in our artist network, that if you go to art school or you go to music school and study composition, it's all about expressing yourself. Well, I know from a historical perspective that self-expression would have been a foreign concept to Johann Sebastian Bach. Did he express himself? Yes. Did he even think about, I'm composing music to express myself? No. Not even Beethoven, who was a very arrogant man and self-obsessed. He believed he was participating in something beyond himself. Right? Artists today don't have that perspective. So, honestly, I get tired of composers' self-expression because I don't see that they really have much to say, because their worldview is very shallow. You know, it lacks a spiritual depth that I'm looking for. So I would say the divide in the church between the artist and the church itself, there's fault on both sides. There's a utilitarian fault on the church's part, of having lost touch with what art can be and should be. And then there's the artist side, by not communicating in a way that actually is intelligible, approachable by everyone, as it should be. This is where I depart from our good friend Francis Schaeffer and his mentor Ruckmacher. I saw the book upstairs, Modern Art and the Death of Culture. I taught a course for several years in New York City, connected with Calvary Baptist Church at New York School of the Bible, on Christianity and art. Actually, the very first class I ever had, Mako Fujimura was part of that class, if you know this visual artist. But right when I was teaching this class is when Andres Serrano's Piss Christ was shown for the first time, a crucifix in a jar of urine. And of course, the church was up in arms about this. And so we had a very hard-hitting discussion. Like, how should we as Christians respond to this? Well, I think it's, you know, and it goes back to Schaeffer talking about Giacometti and the distance of human beings and so on. But I would say, rather than being critical of that, that we should use that as a window for ministry in understanding the world in which we are ministering and living. And Piss Christ goes right with that. And I don't know if any of you know Sister Wendy. She's a Catholic nun that does wonderful videos on art, very knowledgeable about art. And she actually calls Serrano's work a great work of sacred art. Because, why? What did they do to Christ? I mean, they might as well have urinated on him, right? Yeah. They spat on him and they nailed him to a tree. You know? Like, of course, that's what it is. So it does no good for us to take offense. We should expect nothing more or less from the world in which we live than for them to make fun of our Lord in this way. Or perhaps Andres Serrano was actually after something much deeper and more spiritual, right? What's the alternative to this? And every time I have the opportunity to talk to young composers, I talk about this subject. Young artists of any kind, if they'll listen to me, that there was a time where artists were creating art of an aspirational nature, that it was intended to lift people up, right? People often ask me, where are the Mozarts today? Well, how would we even know? I mean, back then, the emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire was looking for the Mozarts and the Goethes, building wonderful buildings that we still celebrate today with the idea that they were building a greater society, lifting people up. Right? So I try to encourage young artists to think in this way, not navel-gazing, not interior, exterior. Think about the good that you're doing and lifting people up. So where does this leave us? Let me bring this back to the first question of why art? Why are we here now? What is our opportunity at this moment in time? Back to Yancey's question to me. Like, I think there's an opportunity for artists at this time in our culture to do some good. People are searching for transcendence. I often have this discussion with pastors about the parallels between my role as a music director of an orchestra and their role as a pastor of a church. We both have congregations, often very opinionated about what we do. The music I program, the sermons they preach, all of that sort of stuff. Their fidelity to the Word of God and how that defines who they are. My fidelity to the score and bringing the composer to the center of the stage rather than myself. You know, all kinds of parallels. But one thing we also agree about is the fact that our congregations, our audiences, are coming for the same thing. They're looking for transcendence. Something beyond themselves. And if we only give them what they experience every day on the street, this is failing in this search for transcendence. Another way of looking at it, we helped plant a church outside of New York City. You may be familiar with Redeemer Presbyterian, Tim Keller, all of that. So we had a satellite church that was planted in Montclair, New Jersey. We were part of it from the very beginning. And a young pastor, we're still very close friends, but one day we were talking about music, and I said to him, Randy, you're serving us haute cuisine in the sermon, but we're eating mud pies as an appetizer. Mm. Like, there's an incongruity here between what we're doing. The artistic expression is not and anywhere in the same realm of what you're doing, right? Art has the ability to create a space, has the ability to create the atmosphere, has the ability to give us the moment in time for contemplation. Great art will do this. It communicates beyond words, maybe ahead of words. It speaks to our souls, right? Prepares our mind. We just ended our season with Bach's B minor Mass. One of the greatest works of art of any kind ever created. Interesting piece of music because Bach wrote it in the last year of his life. There was no commission. There was no performance in his lifetime, and nobody knows why he wrote it. Also interesting is that Bach was a Lutheran composer, and almost all of his works were in German, the vernacular. He was a big fan of Luther, who lived 150 years before him. But he chose the Catholic Mass text in Latin as his final work. Big, very interesting. And the impetus for us programming it was a letter from Lutheran Arts saying, 2017, 500th anniversary of the Reformation, what are you going to do? So my chorus master and I, he's a very staunch Lutheran and a Bach scholar himself, put together a lecture series during Lent at the First Lutheran Church, he and I leading it, but inviting the Lutheran pastor, a Catholic priest, and a Reformed pastor to reflect on this text, this event, this music. It was a type of bridge project connecting us through this Lutheran composer writing on a Catholic Mass text. Very fascinating thing. Like, we started with the Catholic priest coming in and talking about the Mass, the origins of the Mass. How did it ever come about? I mean, how many Protestants even know how the Mass came about to begin with? And he's big sense of humor, this guy. Loved this guy. It was a really beautiful evening. Everybody was, you know, our minds were blown. So we didn't know how the Mass came about. And then the Lutheran talking about the credo, the creed that we all recite, and how Bach sets the text to this creed. You know, and most of the time, composers will set that creed of Beethoven, Mozart, whatever, and it's like credo in unum Deum in unum. You know, I might as well be standing there on a Sunday morning saying, I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. You know, like that. Bach? No. His setting of the credo is a dance of joy from beginning to end. So much ingenuity. Personal, you know, deep and rich. Really a beautiful, beautiful thing. My chorus master said we often call Bach the fifth evangelist. He said, I'm ready to be struck by lightning. This is my chorus master talking, but he said, I would say that when Bach sets scripture and sets the text, that it actually goes beyond the text, beyond the Word of God, in the best way, to bring it to life, to insert it into people's hearts and make it intelligible, but not just intelligible here, but understandable on the heart level. Right? That's the kind of thing that we're after here. Right? I mean, Martin Luther, famous quote, next to the Word of God, the noble art of music is the greatest treasure in the world. Right? Great reformer. Great quote. How does art do this? Not just music. How does it do it? Oftentimes I'll give a devotional, which I won't do right now. Starting with Luke chapter 5, when Jesus is teaching in the boat off the Sea of Galilee. You remember the story, and after he's done, he tells Peter and company to go out and cast their nets for another catch, and he said, well, we've been fishing all night. And he's like, just do it. Get out there. And what happens? Of course, you know, the boat's filled and whatever. But there's a moment in that story. This is before Peter has answered the call. And Peter is on his knees in the slime of the boat when Jesus approaches, and he says, depart from me. I'm a sinful man. And Jesus says, follow me, I'll make you a fisher of men, right? You know the story. What is it that changed in Peter at that moment? I would argue that it was he became vulnerable. Right? He opened his heart. God became vulnerable to us. Our opening to God is to become vulnerable. Right? And then the devotional usually goes to this is how we also relate to one another. People fall in love. When they fall in love, when a couple falls in love, is it because they're posturing and saying, oh, I'm so good looking, I'm so strong? No, it's usually those silly moments when we laugh at each other and we find vulnerability between in our relationship. In the church, don't you find this to be the same case? When do we have fellowship? When do we actually connect with one another? Is it because I'm a Sunday school teacher? I'm the music director? I'm the pastor? No. When we find real fellowship with one another, it's when we recognize that we're saved by grace, all of us. We make ourselves vulnerable, right? Then the next step would be for those outside of the church, recognizing that the only difference between me standing inside the door of the church and the person standing outside is that I have accepted a gift that's been offered to both of us. And I can take no credit for that. Right? I have no credit to take, saved by grace alone. Right? So I create vulnerability with my fellow man, non-Christian. Not by my strength, not by my judgment, but by my vulnerability. So, spinning that out to the artist, when a great work of art is created, it's the artist's vulnerability that creates that space for contemplation. It's the artist bearing their soul, visually, musically, in words, that touches us and creates the opportunity for us to respond. So, back to our culture, back to this moment in time. If politicians can't bridge the divide of Brexit, of the US election, right and left, conservative, liberal, if communication is so distant, how do we speak? And who does the talking? Who creates this? I would suggest that the answer to Philip Yancey's question is that the church has the opportunity to engage artists in the conversation. Not in a utilitarian sense of merely what I can do as a warm-up act for the sermon, but I am a Christian artist. I am an artist who is also a Christian. I live out my faith now for 30 years of professional life outside of the church. I have no place in the church. I've never invited to be part of the church. I don't say that resentfully. It's just the way it is. And every professional artist that I know has the same experience. Painters, sculptors, architects, writers. There's a big disconnect. We're out there, though, and we're living in the world. We're living with our fellow human beings. We know how to relate to them. We understand the culture. We've had to make it in the culture, oftentimes under persecution because we are Christians. So we're living the life that the church wants to connect with. We're in the midst of it. We're in the trenches, as it were. So I would say that the church has an opportunity to connect with this right now. So is there a solution? I don't have a solid answer for it yet, but These three organizations that I talked about at the very beginning, Masterworks Festival, Soli Deo Gloria, and Crescendo, are converging inexplicably right after I met with Philip Yancey. The CEO of Soli Deo Gloria is retiring. The organization is undergoing a sea change. Patrick Cavanaugh, the founder of Masterworks, has stepped down. They're not even holding a festival this summer. Don't know what they're doing. Beat Rink sends an email to me and several other people that are involved in these circles and says, is this a time for Crescendo to play a role? Not that he's looking to take over anything, just asking. So we started exploring this, and that has led me to some very interesting conversations. But a really interesting dinner 2 weeks ago on Lakeshore Drive in Chicago. Bob and Patty Lane. Bob is a retired CEO of John Deere Tractors. Fascinating couple. I'd known Patty. She was on the board of Soli Deo Gloria before. Didn't know her very well. Never met Bob before. But it was the meeting was about the future of Soli Deo Gloria, and all the players were present. I had talked to John Nelson, the founder of STG, during the week before, and I sort of expounded this vision of this time for artists to play a role and Yancey's challenge. So I was very surprised that evening when we were about to talk about the future of Soli Deo Gloria and John just passed the ball to me. I said, why? So I had to start off by saying, well, wait a second, I don't want to usurp the future of Soli Deo Gloria, because basically the Lanes had offered to give a gift of $2 million to Wheaton College to house the future of Soli Deo Gloria. That's what we were there to talk about. But John passed the ball to me instead. And I talked about what I'm just talking about here, and the Lanes immediately said, how do we fund this? There's a summit that needs to happen with Philip Yancey, Jeremy Begbie, Mako Fujimura, Beat Rink. We'll bring all these people together. Just tell us when you want to do this. Right? Again, Yancey's offer to help put us in connection. The other person I didn't mention was Amy Grant, whom I happened to meet right after I met with Yancey. And I told her about this, and she was like, how can I help? Can I go to Crescendo and sing a free concert as a fundraiser? Can I do, you know, like, so people are ready to do things. So I'm wondering, and I, you know, when we go to some questions, I'd be interested to hear what you have to say. I'm wondering if we don't need to start at the top, if it's not church leaders that we need to engage with first. Rather than, because there are individual projects, we all know individual artistic projects in churches that have gone very well. But as a culture, as an evangelical church in particular, we're not engaged. So my dream has been, when I talk with other people about it, like holding an event at the National Day of Prayer, where we bring together the 20 years worth of alumni that we have of Masterworks students and faculty, and we have an orchestra, and I could put a Rick Warren in the same room with the principal trumpet of the New York Philharmonic or the concertmaster of the Philadelphia Orchestra, so that they can have a conversation about this. Because we artists, we know what the pastors think. We know what the church leaders think. We read about it all the time, but I don't think it goes the other way. Right, so how do we create this opportunity, this synergy? I said this had been my idea, but I'm wondering if the European Leadership Forum is not a good place to start for something like that. Because we have leaders from all over Europe here. This is the kind of gathering. You know, just, Charles, you and I haven't talked about this, so forgive me. But I could envision an artistic expression by professional artists at the beginning of each plenary. Short ones. You know, even 5 minutes at each plenary where you had a professional artist that would say a few words about their work and display it, perform it, whatever. What we're after here, I think, is the heart of Europe, the heart of our Western culture. The mind is very important. The apologetics and all of that, having the answers, being ready to give an answer for, you know, how does Peter put it, you know, for whatever's asked of you, being ready. This is all very important, but how do you reach the heart? And I would say that the heart might need to be reached first, and then the answers come. Not always, but we're only thinking about the answers right now. There are ways that we can feed the hungry, that we can clothe the naked, in a literal and a figurative sense, that we can build bridges. I mean, I won't go into it now, but like in the secular world, I do these things called bridge projects. The last one that we had was a musical event, a concert, where we had a Syrian composer and an Iranian composer on the same program. And we talked about cultures in conflict with the musical resolution. And we actually partnered with both churches and the Muslim Community Center. So there's no danger in this, because I know who I am in Christ. I can talk to these people, but these people are our neighbors. Now, we're not talking about whether people should or should not come across borders. Who's our neighbor? Who's my neighbor? Who's my enemy? I would argue that artists actually are in a better position to help answer that question than theologians, because we can actually create the relationship. I can tell you the power of sharing music among people. We do it with our Lakota Music Project between Native Americans, and addressing racial prejudice through sharing music together. It's a very powerful program. It works. So that's the end of my talk.